This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Daniel Deronda by George Eliot. Chapter 51. She held the spindle as she sat. Erinna, with the thick-coiled mat of raven hair and deepest agate eyes, gazing with a sad surprise at surging visions of her destiny, to spin the byssus drearily in insect labor, while the throng of gods and men wrought deeds that poets wrought in song. When Deronda presented himself at the door of his mother's apartment in the Italia, he felt some revival of his boyhood with its premature agitations. The two servants in the antechamber looked at him markedly, a little surprised that the doctor their lady had come to consult was this striking young gentleman, whose appearance gave even the severe lines of an evening dress the credit of adornment. But Deronda could notice nothing until, the second door being opened, he found himself in the presence of a figure which at the other end of the large room stood awaiting his approach. She was covered, except as to her face and part of her arms, with black lace hanging loosely from the summit of her whitening hair to the long train stretching from her tall figure. Her arms, naked to the elbow except for some rich bracelets, were folded before her, and the fine poise of her head made it look handsomer than it really was. But Deronda felt no interval of observation before he was close in front of her, holding the hand she had put out and then raising it to his lips. She still kept her hand in his and looked at him examiningly, while his chief consciousness was that her eyes were piercing and her face so mobile that the next moment she might look like a different person. For even while she was examining him, there was a play of the brow and nostril which made a tacit language. Deronda dared no movement, not able to conceive what sort of manifestation her feeling demanded. But he felt himself changing color like a girl, and yet wondering at his own lack of emotion. He had lived through so many ideal meetings with his mother, and they had seemed more real than this. He could not even conjecture in what language she would speak to him. He imagined it would not be English. Suddenly she let fall his hand and placed both hers on his shoulders, while her face gave out a flash of admiration in which every worn line disappeared and seemed to leave a restored youth. "You are a beautiful creature," she said in a low, melodious voice, with syllables which had what might be called a foreign but agreeable outline. "I knew you would be." Then she kissed him on each cheek, and he returned the kisses. But it was something like a greeting between royalties. She paused a moment while the lines were coming back into her face, and then said in a colder tone, "I am your mother, but you can have no love for me. I have thought of you more than of any other being in the world," said Deronda, his voice trembling nervously. "I am not like what you thought I was," said the mother decisively, withdrawing her hands from his shoulders and folding her arms as before, looking at him as if she invited him to observe her. He had often pictured her face in his imagination as one which had a likeness to his own. He saw some of the likeness now, but amidst more striking differences. She was a remarkable-looking being. What was it that gave her son a painful sense of aloofness? Her worn beauty had a strangeness in it, as if she were not quite a human mother, but a Melusina who had ties with some world which is independent of ours. "I used to think that you might be suffering," said Deronda, anxious above all not to wound her. "I used to wish that I could be a comfort to you." "I am suffering, but with a suffering that you can't comfort," said the princess, in a harder voice than before, moving to a sofa where cushions had been carefully arranged for her. "Sit down." She pointed to a seat near her, and then discerning some distress in Deronda's face, she added more gently, "I am not suffering at this moment. I am at ease now. I am able to talk. Deronda seated himself and waited for her to speak again. It seemed as if he were in the presence of a mysterious fate rather than of the longed-for mother. He was beginning to watch her with wonder from the spiritual distance to which she had thrown him. "No," she began, "I did not send for you to comfort me. I could not know beforehand, I don't know now, what you will feel toward me. I have not the foolish notion that you can love me merely because I am your mother, when you have neither seen or heard of me in all your life. But I thought I chose something better for you than being with me. I did not think I deprived you of anything worth having." "You cannot wish me to believe that your affection would not have been worth having," said Deronda, finding that she paused as if she expected him to make some answer. "I don't mean to speak ill of myself," said the princess, with proud impetuosity, "but I had not much affection to give you. I did not want affection. I had been stifled with it. I wanted to live out the life that was in me, and not to be hampered with other lives. You wonder what I was. I was no princess then." She rose with a sudden movement and stood as she had done before. Deronda immediately rose too. He felt breathless. "No princess in this tame life that I live in now. I was a great singer, and I acted as well as I sang. All the rest were poor beside me. Men followed me from one country to another. I was living a myriad lives in one. I did not want a child." There was a passionate self-defense in her tone. She had cast all precedent out of her mind. Precedent had no excuse for her, and she could only seek a justification in the intensest words she could find for her experience. She seemed to fling out the last words against some possible reproach in the mind of her son, who had to stand and hear them, clutching his coat collar as if he were keeping himself above water by it, and feeling his blood in the sort of commotion that might have been excited if he had seen her going through some strange rite of a religion which gave a sacredness to crime. What else had she to tell him? She went on with the same intensity and a sort of pale illumination in her face. "I did not want to marry. I was forced into marrying your father. Forced, I mean, by my father's wishes and commands. And besides, it was my best way of getting some freedom. I could rule my husband, but not my father. I had a right to be free. I had a right to seek my freedom from a bondage that I hated." She seated herself again, while there was that subtle movement in her eyes and closed lips which is like the suppressed continuation of speech. Deronda continued standing, and after a moment or two she looked up at him with a less defiant pleading as she said, "And the bondage I hated for myself I wanted to keep you from. What better could the most loving mother have done? I relieved you from the bondage of having been born a Jew." "Then I am a Jew," Deronda burst out with a deep-voiced energy that made his mother shrink a little backward against her cushions. "My father was a Jew, and you are a Jewess?" "Yes, your father was my cousin," said the mother, watching him with a change in her look as if she saw something that she might have to be afraid of. "I am glad of it," said Deronda impetuously in the veiled voice of passion. He could not have imagined beforehand how he would have come to say that which he had never hitherto admitted. He could not have dreamed that it would be in impulsive opposition to his mother. He was shaken by a mixed anger which no reflection could come soon enough to check, against this mother who it seemed had borne him unwillingly, had willingly made herself a stranger to him, and perhaps was now making herself known unwillingly. This last suspicion seemed to flash some explanation over her speech. But the mother was equally shaken by an anger differently mixed, and her frame was less equal to any repression. The shaking with her was visibly physical, and her eyes looked the larger for her pallid excitement as she said violently, "Why do you say you are glad? You are an English gentleman. I secured you that." "You did not know what you secured me. How could you choose my birthright for me?" said Deronda, throwing himself sideways into his chair again, almost unconsciously, and leaning his arm over the back while he looked away from his mother. He was fired with an intolerance that seemed foreign to him, but he was now trying hard to master himself and keep silence. A horror had swept in upon his anger lest he should say something too hard in this moment which made an epoch never to be recalled. There was a pause before his mother spoke again, and when she spoke her voice had become more firmly resistant in its finely varied tones. "I chose for you what I would have chosen for myself. How could I know that you would have had the spirit of my father in you? How could I know that you would love what I hated? If you really love to be a Jew." The last words had such bitterness in them that anyone overhearing might have supposed some hatred had arisen between the mother and son. But Deronda had recovered his fuller self. He was recalling his sensibilities to what life had been and actually was for her, whose best years were gone, and who, with the signs of suffering in her frame, was now exerting herself to tell him of a past which was not his alone, but also hers. His habitual shame at the acceptance of events as if they were his only helped him even here. As he looked at his mother silently after her last words, his face regained some of its penetrative calm, yet it seemed to have a strangely agitating influence over her. Her eyes were fixed on him with a sort of fascination, but not with any repose of maternal delight. "Forgive me if I speak hastily," he said with diffident gravity. "Why have you resolved now on disclosing to me what you took care to have me brought up in ignorance of? Why, since you seem angry that I should be glad?" "Oh, the reasons of our actions," said the princess with a ring of something like sarcastic scorn. "When you are as old as I am, it will not seem so simple a question. Why did you do this? People talk of their motives in a cut-and-dried way. Every woman is supposed to have the same set of motives, or else to be a monster. I am not a monster, but I have not felt exactly what other women feel, or say they feel, for fear of being thought unlike others. When you reproach me in your heart for sending you away from me, you mean that I ought to say I felt about you as other women say they feel about their children. I did not feel that. I was glad to be freed from you. But I did well for you, and I gave you your father's fortune. Do I seem now to be revoking everything? Well, there are reasons. I feel many things that I cannot understand. A fatal illness has been growing in me for a year. I shall very likely not live another year. I will not deny anything I have done. I will not pretend to love where I have no love. But shadows are rising round me. Sickness makes them. If I have wronged the dead, I have but little time to do what I left undone." The varied transitions of tone with which this speech was delivered were as perfect as the most accomplished actress could have made them. The speech was in fact a piece of what may be called sincere acting. This woman's nature was one in which all feeling, and all the more when it was tragic as well as real, immediately became matter of conscious representation. Experience immediately passed into drama, and she acted her own emotions. In a minor degree, this is nothing uncommon, but in the princess the acting had a rare perfection, a physiognomy, voice, and gesture. It would not be true to say that she felt less because of this double consciousness. She felt, that is, her mind went through, all the more, but with a difference. Each nucleus of pain or pleasure had a deep atmosphere of the excitement or spiritual intoxication, which at once exalts and deadens. But Deronda made no reflection of this kind. All his thoughts hung on the purport of what his mother was saying. Her tones and her wonderful face entered into his agitation without being noted. What he longed for with an awed desire was to know as much as she would tell him of the strange mental conflict under which it seemed he had been brought into the world. What his compassionate nature made the controlling idea within him were the suffering and the confession that breathed through her later words, and these forbade any further question, when she paused and remained silent, with her brow knit, her head turned a little away from him, and her large eyes fixed as if on something incorporeal. He must wait for her to speak again, and she did so with strange abruptness, turning her eyes upon him suddenly and saying more quickly, "Sir Hugo has written much about you. He tells me you have a wonderful mind, you comprehend everything, you are wiser than he is with all his 60 years. You say you are glad to know that you were born a Jew. I am not going to tell you that I have changed my mind about that. Your feelings are against mine. You don't thank me for what I did. Shall you comprehend your mother, or only blame her?" "There is not a fiber within me but makes me wish to comprehend her," said Deronda, meeting her sharp gaze solemnly. "It is a bitter reversal of my longing to think of blaming her. What I have been most trying to do for 15 years is to have some understanding of those who differ from myself." "Then you have become unlike your grandfather in that," said the mother, "though you are a young copy of him in your face. He never comprehended me, or if he did, he only thought of fettering me into obedience. I was to be what he called the Jewish woman under pain of his curse. I was to feel everything I did not feel and believe everything I did not believe. I was to feel awe for the bit of parchment in the mezuzah over the door, to dread lest a bit of butter should touch a bit of meat, to think it beautiful that men should bind the tefillin on them and women not, to adore the wisdom of such laws, however silly they might seem to me. I was to love the long prayers in the ugly synagogue, and the howling and the gabbling and the dreadful fasts and the tiresome feasts, and my father's endless discoursing about our people, which was a thunder without meaning in my ears. I was to care forever about what Israel had been, and I did not care at all. I cared for the wide world and all that I could represent in it. I hated living under the shadow of my father's strictness. Teaching, teaching for everlasting. This you must be, that you must not be, pressed on me like a frame that got tighter and tighter as I grew. I wanted to live a large life with freedom to do what everyone else did and be carried along in a great current, not obliged to care. Ah!" Here her tone changed to one of a more bitter incisiveness. "You are glad to have been born a Jew. You say so. That is because you have not been brought up as a Jew. That separateness seems sweet to you because I saved you from it. When you resolved on that, you meant that I should never know my origin," said Deronda impulsively. "You have at least changed in your feeling on that point." "Yes, that was what I meant. That is what I persevered in, and it is not true to say that I have changed. Things have changed in spite of me. I am still the same Leonora." She pointed with her forefinger to her breast. "Here within me is the same desire, the same will, the same choice. But—" She spread out her hands, palm upward on each side of her, as she paused with a bitter compression of her lip, then let her voice fall into muffled, rapid utterance. "Events come upon us like evil enchantments, and thoughts, feelings, apparitions in the darkness are events, are they not? I don't consent. We only consent to what we love. I obey something tyrannic." She spread out her hands again. "I am forced to be withered, to feel pain, to be dying slowly. Do I love that? Well, I have been forced to obey my dead father. I have been forced to tell you that you are a Jew, and deliver to you what he commanded me to deliver. I beseech you to tell me what moved you, when you were young, I mean, to take the course you did," said Deronda, trying by this reference to the past to escape from what to him was the heart-rending piteousness of this mingled suffering and defiance. "I gather that my grandfather opposed your bent to be an artist. Though my own experience has been quite different, I enter into the painfulness of your struggle. I can imagine the hardship of an enforced renunciation." "No," said the princess, shaking her head and folding her arms with an air of decision. "You are not a woman. You may try, but you can never imagine what it is to have a man's force of genius in you, and yet to suffer the slavery of being a girl. To have a pattern cut out, 'This is the Jewish woman. This is what you must be. This is what you are wanted for. A woman's heart must be of such a size and no larger, else it must be pressed small like Chinese feet. Her happiness is to be made as cakes are, by a fixed recipe.' That was what my father wanted. He wished I had been a son. He cared for me as a makeshift link. His heart was set on his Judaism. He hated that Jewish woman should be thought of by the Christian world as a sort of ware to make public singers and actresses of, as if we were not the more enviable for that. That is a chance of escaping from bondage." "Was my grandfather a learned man?" said Deronda, eager to know particulars that he feared his mother might not think of. She answered impatiently, putting up her hand, "Oh, yes, and a clever physician, and good. I don't deny that he was good. A man to be admired in a play, grand, with an iron will, like the old Foscari before he pardons. But such men turn their wives and daughters into slaves. They would rule the world if they could. But not ruling the world, they throw all the weight of their will on the necks and souls of women. But nature sometimes thwarts them. My father had no other child than his daughter, and she was like himself." She had folded her arms again, and looked as if she were ready to face some impending attempt at mastery.